is this, to see the U.S. behaving so badly.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Pam Miller, co-chair of the International Pollutants Elimination Network, known as IPEN, executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, speaking to us from Anchorage, Alaska. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Hami Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Trina Durte, Maria Studio, Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman, Nermin Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch, open daily at 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers. A talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an ICE agent is under investigation, accused of bailing out a white supremacist.
The Oregon Senate has passed a bill that would open the sale of Oregon-grown marijuana to other states.
And in international news, the United States has announced a ban on all air transport between the U.S. and Venezuela.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 16th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Annette Newell. Willamette Week is reporting that an ICE agent is under investigation for allegedly bailing out a white supremacist. Donovan Flippo, a member of far-right neo-fascist group Proud Boys, was arrested last June for felony assault charges after attacking a Portland man on the sidewalk. Records show that ICE agent Nicholas Careful paid the $750 bail for Flippo just hours after he was transferred to the Multnomah County Jail. Last year, Willamette Week reported that Careful was the first ICE employee to go on the record with allegations that Portland cops refused to assist federal immigration agents while they were surrounded by a protest blockade.
Congress is holding hearings this week on a bill that would expand public lands protection in Oregon. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley introduced the Oregon Recreation Enhancement Act, which would extend safeguards for the Rogue River and create protections for parts of the Molalla River in Clackamas County, as well as other rivers in southwestern Oregon. Here's how Wyden explained the need for the changes.
I appreciate the chance to discuss legislation that Senator Merkley and I have authored to protect and enhance three of my state's most iconic recreation destinations. S-1262, the Oregon Recreation Enhancement Act, would establish two new recreation areas on the Rogue and Molalla Rivers. These rivers are home to some of the world's most extraordinary salmon and steelhead runs, which are the backbone of Oregon's local recreation economies. This legislation would expand the current Wild Rogue Wilderness area in the rugged canyons and steep cliffs off the Rogue River. This is truly one of the wildest and most remote landscapes in southern Oregon, with efforts to protect and conserve these lands persisting for over a half century. When Congress passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act and designated 44.5 miles of the Rogue. Lastly, the bill permanently protects several sources of clean drinking water from hazardous mining. The special headwaters for the Smith and Illinois River provide thousands of Oregon families with clean drinking water and are critical salmon habitats. Based on the support of the local community, the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management issued a temporary 20-year ban on new mining claims in the region in 2017. The temporary ban gives Congress more time to pursue a permanent solution. That's what this bill does. And the legislation builds on what I call the Oregon Way, our traditional conservation ethic that's been fundamental to the livability of my home state. The areas the legislation seeks to protect are truly public treasures and should remain places to recreate for generations to come. And that's why, based on local concerns, this bill ensures that public land managers can do important preemptive forest health and wildfire resiliency work within the recreation areas and wilderness expansion, making sure these landscapes are around for future generations means hazardous fuels and thinning work can and must continue. I've heard all these stories about how you can't protect special places in the West because all you're doing is giving short shrift to the effort to deal with fire. Nothing could be further from the truth. This committee led the effort on trailblazing approaches like ending fire borrowing, and the list goes on and on. But what this legislation does is it protects special places and also makes it clear that we are going to be all in the fight against fire. Thinning work, hazardous fuels work can continue.
And Pam Marsh, a state representative from Ashland near the Rogue River, calls the bill a generational investment that's especially important because of the greater demand to visit these places.
You can be on the Rogue and you can really be out in the middle of nowhere on this tremendous river with these wonderful rapids and feel like you're the only person on the planet. That's a pretty extraordinary opportunity, and that's why people go back and back and back to the Rogue.
The measure would create a 30,000-acre recreation area near the Molalla River, establish the 98,000-acre Rogue Canyon Recreation Area, and expand the Wild Rogue Wilderness Area by about 60,000 acres. It would also ban mining in 100,000 acres of the Calmeopsis Wilderness Area.
Zach Collier owns Northwest Rafting Company and says that bill makes amends for unfinished business. Lawmakers left out protections for these areas in a larger public lands package that was passed earlier this year, but Wyden and Merkley vowed to bring them back. Collier noted these places are integral for local communities in Oregon that rely on recreation, and they're also important to the state's bigger recreational picture. According to the Outdoor Industry Association, outdoor recreation in Oregon generates more than $16 billion in consumer spending and more than 170,000 jobs.
We have Keen who's selling shoes, and we have Columbia Sportswear that's selling jackets. So the recreation goes beyond just the direct recreational impact. It goes through our larger recreation economy here in Oregon, which includes the equipment side. I'm somebody who's paddled all over the world. To me, these creeks are the most unique and rare things I've ever seen. They're just really special. So I'm really excited that they're up to be protected. They're very deserving of protection.
Protections from mining in the Calmeopsis Wilderness are especially important to Collier. He said it's a mecca for botanists and a landscape unlike anywhere on the planet.
Burgerville is closing one of its oldest restaurants on June 16th. The Beaverton Burgerville has been there for 50 years, but won't be able to make the necessary updates to the building due to environmental concerns surrounding nearby wetlands. Burgerville made national news last year when one of its branches voted to become the first fast food workers union in the country. Other Burgerville branches continue to fight corporate efforts to silence their demands as workers call for better wages and working conditions.
Tribal leaders and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are working to reintroduce condors in Northern California. The birds, whose historic range stretches into Oregon, were almost extinct and are still threatened. One threat to their survival has been lead ammunition. Though California is banning it as of July 1st, in Oregon it is still allowed. Suzanne Potter reports.
The California condor may soon return to the skies in northwestern California, but conservation groups are calling for action to improve their chances of survival. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, along with the Yurok tribe, have proposed reintroducing the condor to the northern part of its historic range, which includes Oregon and northern Nevada. However, Pamela Flick with the group Defenders of Wildlife says the states need some policy changes to pave the way.
Defenders of Wildlife remains concerned about releasing condors into a landscape rife with threats to their continued survival, from the familiar threat of lead poisoning to the emerging threat of rodenticide poisoning.
California's ban on lead ammunition takes full effect July 1st. Oregon's lead ammunition program is voluntary, and Nevada doesn't regulate it at all. The public can weigh in on the federal environmental assessment on the condor reintroduction program tomorrow morning in Klamath and at an evening meeting in the town of Arcata. Condors also fall victim to certain types of anticoagulant rat poison by eating tainted carcasses. Assembly Bill 1788 partially addresses the issue by banning the chemicals on state land. However, Flick notes that the main problem is with illegal marijuana operations.
Thousands of illegal marijuana farms have been identified statewide here in California, with a substantial concentration of these sites located in the area of release in Northwest California.
The California condor almost went extinct in 1985, with only 22 birds remaining. But there are now 290 birds in Southern California and the Baja Peninsula in Mexico, thanks to successful reintroduction programs there. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Oregon Senate has passed a bill that would open the sale of Oregon-grown marijuana to other states. Senate Bill 582 allows Oregon's governor to enter the marijuana sales with other state governors. The bill would address the Oregon marijuana market's continued problems with overproduction, which has driven down prices and put many sellers out of business. By some estimates, Oregon currently has enough marijuana already in production to last for the next 6 years, even if farms stopped all production right now. The plan for marijuana sales across state lines to Washington and California would need federal approval before it could go into effect.
The rapidly increasing price of prescription drugs leaves some people trying to make difficult decisions about where to spend their money. Eric Tegenoff reports on how Oregon lawmakers are trying to tackle the problem.
Oregon lawmakers are looking at ways to address the spiking cost of prescription drugs. Two bills in the legislature could bring down prices, which would be a relief to older Oregonians. According to a U.S. Senate report from last year, the price for some commonly prescribed name-brand drugs are increasing at 10 times the rate of inflation. Geneva Craig is a registered nurse in Medford and an AARP Oregon Executive Council member. She wants the state to act soon because of the effects she's seen from unaffordable drugs.
Some patients that I've seen in the hospital are in the hospital because they had to make a choice about being able to afford the drugs, their medication, or the rent, food. Those types of choices had to be made.
The bills now being considered would require companies to give 60 days advance notice before raising the price of a drug and to allow prescription drugs to be imported from Canada. Mark Griffith, healthcare advocate with the consumer group Osperg, says House Bill 2658, requiring advance notice of price increases, could help put the market back into balance.
The drug companies are holding more of the power than they should be, and to some extent this is something that's going to help level the playing field by giving insurance companies as well as consumers who are able to act on choice to be in a better position to respond to planned price changes.
Griffith says the advance notice would give insurance companies time to switch to a more affordable drug, putting pressure on drug companies to keep their prices down. Pharmaceutical representatives say the bill could threaten manufacturers' supply chains, but HB 2658 passed the House in April and is now in the Senate. Griffith notes the other bill, HB 2689, has counterparts in states as politically diverse as Vermont and Florida, and both have approved Canadian import programs. Opponents point to safety concerns, but Griffith says Canadian standards are on par with the United States. He says the real benefit comes from the savings.
Prescription drugs that are sold in Canada, and these are basically the same exact product, are much, much less expensive. They could be as much as 80% lower, but something like 30% to 50% lower in price is pretty typical.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The American Society of Civil Engineers has graded Oregon's infrastructure, and guess what? The findings are not so good. The group of experts studied data on several structures throughout the state, and the results show that much of the state's roads, bridges, and water systems are at risk due to deterioration and lack of proper maintenance. It's estimated that about 30% of the levees around Oregon are in unacceptable condition, with minimal inspections taking place. The condition of the majority of the state's levees is unknown. The committee is calling for stronger leadership on the issue and asking for more planning and funding. The director of Oregon Transportation acknowledged that more needs to be done to improve conditions around the state.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on new cures for leukemia and other cancers. At 6 o'clock, it is Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it is the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, it's going to be rainy again, low down to 51. Tomorrow, that rain is going to continue up to a high of 61. Today in history, on this date in Joan of Arc was canonized in Rome in 1920, and she officially became a Catholic saint. The quote of the day is from Joan of Arc, who said, "Children say that people are hung sometimes for speaking the truth."
Utopia PDX is holding its monthly health event for Asian Pacific Islander queer communities this Saturday, May 18th. KBOO News spoke today with Manu Malo Alaima about what the organization does and what's on tap at this upcoming
health. My name is Manu Malo, and I am the co-founder and co-chair for Utopia PDX, which stands for United Territories of Pacific Islanders Alliance Portland. And we provide sacred spaces to strengthen the minds and bodies of cutie pies, queer and trans Pacific Islanders, through community organizing, political engagement, and cultural stewardship. So this particular Saturday, we are hosting our second annual Pacifica Health Fair, and we have wonderful services, resources that are healthcare related to not only the Pacific Islander community, but the LGBT community, and anyone who seeks to get these resources.
Manu Malo, how did you come together?
We came together 2 years ago. Utopia PDX formed in April of 2017 because we did not see ourselves represented in our Pacific Islander community, nor did we see ourselves represented and the LGBTQ community. So myself and some friends got together, formed Utopia Portland, and we've been busy ever since. We became a 501c3 last year in April. So a year after we were formed, we got our 501c3 status as a nonprofit organization.
Who is part of your community helping Utopia PDX move forward?
So part of our community, we have an array of Pacific Islanders that are represented in Utopia. We have Palauans, we have folks from the Caroline Islands, Samoa, American Samoa, Tonga, and the lovely Aloha state of Hawaii. And beyond just identifying as a cutie pie, we have bonds and connections with the Samoan community through the Samoan Pacific Development Corporation, which is another 501c3 nonprofit. We have ties with Living Islands, which is a Marshallese nonprofit organization, 501c3, that focuses on climate change and how it impacts the Marshall Islands. We also have connections with APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, with Pride Northwest, which is a hosting organization for Portland Pride for the past 25 years. And what community are we not a part of? Micronesian Islander community. So there's several different ways that we've been involved and connected, either through our personal Pacific Islander identity and or just through the work that we do. We are easily connected.
All right. And now I want to move on to the work that you do. Now, we're going to be talking in a minute more about the health event you have coming up, but you have regular events. What are some of the other events that you have that we could be looking forward to?
Sure. So we currently host a Talanoa series, and Talanoa roughly means storytelling. So we have storytelling events quarterly, four times a year, and we basically take a topic that meets us at our intersection of being a Pacific Islander and LGBTQ, and we have a storytelling session about it. So you may not know this, but in most Pacific Islander cultures before written language, we are really invested in oral tradition. So we are natural storytellers. And the way we approach a lot of the issues, whether it's at the village level, in terms of how you distribute resources, usually have you discuss, you know, how do we do this? So just taking that notion of what we've done in our Pacific homelands and bringing that here with topics that are relevant for us living in the greater Portland metro area and what we face here has been a way to engage with not just our QDBI population, but our Pacific Islander community as well.
Now let's talk about the event that's coming up, the health fair. What kind of services will be there and who is participating?
Great. So we are providing lead testing, blood pressure screening, blood sugar screening, HIV testing, and I believe we will also be having QDPOC mental health there. That's queer and trans people of color mental health, transgender health services provided by a partnership project at OHSU. We have a Micronesian Islander community that'll be their Samoa Pacific Development Corporation, the American Red Cross, which is the host venue. And we also have How to Become a Foster Parent, which is with the Oregon Department of Human Services. We also have CAP, the Cascade AIDS Project, who will be administering the HIV testing. And EMO, HIV Day Center, is also going to be present. And SMRC, Sexual and Gender Minority Youth Resource Center. So just a host of different health-related support systems and resources for folks who look at health and wellness. And I feel that we offer a variety of things to help people navigate their lives here in Portland.
Manu Malo, I'm so interested that you're having someone there from DHS to talk about how to be a foster parent, because this is one of the hardest issues. And it's fascinating to me that you're weaving it into a health event. Talk a little bit about the health of our kids and why we should be paying attention to, you know, having stronger foster care systems and having and encouraging each other to learn how to be foster parents. How does that impact our community health?
We get emails from various people who
you know, don't know about Utopia, but somebody had mentioned it to them, and they were looking for, like, eligible Pacific Islander adults that could possibly foster this family of six Chukchi children. They're all siblings, and they didn't want them broken up. So I think that was, you know, an eye-opening experience. You know, it's not a direct service that we provide as Utopia, but somebody reached out to us, and we're like, who do we know? And so when we connected with the Oregon Department of Human Services regarding, you know, how this emergency foster parent program, you know, can happen for folks that we just don't know. You're asking us, and nobody's ever come into our community and say, this is the application process. You know, we need more of you represented, because there are children that identify as Pacific Islanders that are in our system, but we notice that we don't have any Pacific Islander adults as foster parents, or we haven't done any recruitment until now. So I feel like the way we start learning that there is a gap or a dire need is when folks start reaching out to us, and we feel responsive to try to meet that need. You can reach us at our Facebook page, which is at Utopia Portland. We have a donation button, and it will give you our tax ID once you donate to us. And I think, you know, when we say that we support people of color, and when we say that we support Indigenous people, and when we say that we support LGBT folks, the best way to really show support is to show up and to donate and to immerse yourself in our lives just as much as we've invested and immersed ourselves in everyone else's lives. And that's basically it.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving. The United States has announced a ban on all air transport between the U.S. and Venezuela. That ban takes effect immediately. It affects both cargo and passenger flights to the South American country. This is the latest step by the U.S. to try to delegitimize the elected government in Venezuela and push the coup government of Juan Guaido. This morning, police removed Code Pink protesters from the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. They'd been occupying the embassy for more than a month in support of existing government in Venezuela. Their goal was to try to prevent the U.S.-supported coup government representatives from taking over the embassy.
And American civil rights icon Jesse Jackson and a group of activists were trying to deliver food in Venezuela, but violence interrupted their effort. Take a listen to what happened.
Hey, you're pushing us.
This is the one right here. Please stand back.
This man is assaulting us.
Captain,
this is the one right here. This man is assaulting us.
Calm down. Can you let go?
He's stealing right in front of the police. He's a thief right in front of the police. A thief. He's stealing right in front of the police.
Here you go, sir.
This is ours.
This is ours.
Tell this man to just get off.
Do your job. Who do you protect? Please get off.
He's asking nicely.
Who do you protect?
Let go of the bag, man.
Do your job.
And this morning, police arrested four members of the Embassy Protective Collective, Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, Adrian Pine, and David Pine. This came after the U.S. government raided the Venezuelan embassy. Zeese and Flowers are with the group PopularResistance.org. Pine is an associate professor of anthropology at American University. Their lawyers call those arrests an open violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations.
This morning, the majority Republican Missouri State Senate passed a bill restricting abortions after 8 weeks. That bill will now head to the state House, also controlled by Republicans, for a vote. Missouri is now the third state in the past 2 weeks that has passed laws essentially outlawing abortion. Alabama and Georgia both passed laws banning abortions with no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. Alabama legislators have publicly said they passed the law to try to push a challenge to Roe v. Wade to the U.S. Supreme Court.
New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez confronted a CEO in the pharmaceutical industry over the price tag of a drug that reduces the risk of HIV. The drug costs almost $2,000 a month in the United States, but sells for only $8 in Australia. The CEO blamed the high price on its patent, saying it's protected in the U.S. Generic forms of the drug are available in the rest of the world.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has announced it will no longer accept donations from the Sackler family because of the family's direct involvement in the opioid epidemic. The Sacklers are one of the richest families in the U.S. with a combined net worth of over $13 billion. The Sackler family held extensive control over the distribution of OxyContin through their private company, Purdue Pharma. Since its release, overdoses relating to OxyContin have killed an estimated 200,000 Americans. That is according to the Center for Disease Control.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 16, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Emily Gresham Beamer, Trevor Scott Carlson, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Randall Rigo. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Willamette on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. For tomorrow, Endangered Species Day on KBOO. At 7, it is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting. Ani takes your calls on that. And at 9, Veterans Voice Radio deals with the matters of war and peace and veterans' health. At 10, it's Radio Zine featuring an interview with Give Us Shelter. That's a group that's walking to Salem from Portland for housing justice. 10:30 a.m. is Film at 11. They will be welcoming cinematographer Eric Edwards to discuss J.T. Leroy, the new docudrama about the famous literary hoaxer who fooled hundreds of celebrities. And at 11, Pacific Underground has a discussion about Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, just go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today at KBOO News In Depth, 40 years of trying and waiting for a cure for a type of blood cancer. That's a long time. And now finally, this year, there are 8 new FDA-approved drugs to treat acute myeloid leukemia. I spoke to Stephanie Carlson, the executive director of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in Western states, including Oregon, who explains how Oregon is right at the center of the research that's now finally saving lives.
Let's talk about the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and your connection to this particular trial. Not from the science point of view, but like, it's tough to get to raise money mm-hmm. for research. It's expensive, yep. right? So
yep.
that's where you guys come in and right. do a lot of hard work.
Right, and that's so we fund research. As far as the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society goes, the money that we raise is put towards three buckets: patient services and financial aid. delayed, advocacy, and then research. And research is where we put the majority of the funds. And the Beat AML clinical trial started in 2013 when Dr. Lou DeGennaro, our CEO, and Dr. Brian Drucker came together and they said, we need to do something for AML patients because their survival rates are less than 50%, and we haven't seen any new drugs for 40 years. And really, this kind of came from Dr. Brian Drucker's success with Gleevec. He and Dr. Liu said, we need to do for AML patients what we did for CML patients. And that's how this all started. And in the last 5 years, we have put $100 million towards AML research alone.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know it was that much.
It is. And one of the things that makes this clinical trial unique is LLS is actually leading the clinical trial. We are the first nonprofit organization that took this to the FDA, and we are the ones setting the rules when it comes to the cancer centers participating. And you heard Dr. Barade speak to the fact that this clinical trial wouldn't be successful if it weren't for the collaboration between the cancer centers, LLS, the pharmaceutical companies, and the FDA. And that was one of the main rules we set in the very beginning, because we understood that if we want to move quickly with this disease, and if we want to understand the disease quicker, if we want to understand which treatments work and don't work quicker, it's going to take all of us working together. And that was really, that's a tone that Dr. Brian Drucker sets here at OHSU. It's very obvious. And that's why we've all just worked so well together with it.
Mm-hmm. How many people are at risk of getting leukemia? I'm just trying to get an idea of that.
I don't know leukemia specifically, but as far as all blood cancers go, every year there's less than 200,000 new diagnoses of blood cancers a year. That can include leukemia, lymphomas, and multiple myelomas. Because it's such a that total population is such a small number, blood cancers are actually considered an orphan disease. And that's one of the reasons why it took so long for the focus for AML to us to focus on AML, because when you talk the general population and when you talk other cancer diagnoses, the amount of new diagnoses for AML patients is relatively small. So there's not a lot of focus on it. Mm-hmm. That's where we step in, and that's where we're proud, is we look at blood cancer diagnoses and we look at the patients and we look at the survival rates and also take account the treatments and how well they're working. And that's when we find a small population that has low survival rates, that hasn't had new treatments in years, that's where we focus, because we see us as the organization that can actually step in and make the changes that need to be made on behalf of the two patients.
You know, I think from a patient's point of view, hearing, well, you've got cancer, but it's an orphan disease, mm-hmm. which means there hasn't been the money for funding mm-hmm. research for new treatments. That's got to be pretty devastating for those folks.
Yeah, it's horrible. And if you just think, so I've been with the organization now for 6 years, and when I started with LLS and I would hear the diagnoses AML, my heart would break a little bit, because I kind of knew that the person, you know, had a tough road in front of them. That doesn't happen now. Now when I hear somebody is diagnosed with AML, I actually get excited and I say, you know what, we've got resources for you. We have this clinical trial. We're partnering with OHSU. Some of the best blood cancer minds in the world are actually focused on this disease, and this is actually hopeful.
Mm. Those eight new treatments that she spoke of that have just started being used within the last year or so, mm-hmm. That's really groundbreaking. Did a lot of that research happen here, or is connected to Oregon?
It's connected to Oregon. The way that the clinical trial is set up is right now there are 10 cancer centers that are participating, and they're all testing multiple drugs at once. And so it's actually just, I would say a lot of it has been OHSU, because that's really, this is where the Beat AML clinical trial started in 2013. But it's all of those cancer centers that are now participating. You know, it's kind of the work of everybody that's collaborating, even the pharmaceutical companies and the FDA that said, yes, you know, we'll allow a nonprofit organization to manage this clinical trial. Mm-hmm. That took a lot of work and convincing.
I'd heard that there's an unusually high rate of blood cancers in the Pacific Northwest and in Oregon. Is that true?
I haven't seen anything. No. When we look at new diagnoses, it's about on average. And I cover Oregon, Idaho, and Montana, and every year there are around 4,000 new blood cancer diagnoses. And again, that includes the leukemia, lymphoma, and multiple myeloma.
Uh-huh. Are there certain people who seem to be more at risk?
No, I wish we knew that, because I think it would make treatment a lot easier. ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, is the number one cancer in children under the age of 15. So we know that. We also know that African American males are more susceptible to multiple myeloma. But that's really all that we understand.
Mm-hmm. And everybody wants to hear about the next Gleevec. I mean, that's something that has been going on for decades. And do you think we might be on the cusp of that?
So it's funny. We have Gleevec set the tone and really changed the way that researchers and healthcare providers looked at chemotherapy. And they said, you know what, maybe we can do this differently. Instead of killing all the cells in the body, we can actually target which ones need to be attacked. And the newest Gleevec, I'd say, the newest groundbreaker in research is immunotherapy. So if you've heard of CAR T immunotherapy, which the first FDA approval for that was in August of 2017, mm-hmm. Our CEO calls CAR T immunotherapy Star Wars type science, because we're literally unlocking the body's own immune system to fight cancer. And the results that we've seen for relapsed ALL patients, for non-Hodgkin's patients, they've never been seen before. We have such a high percentage of cure rates with immunotherapy, and it started in blood cancers, and now it's being looked at and used in tumorous cancers, in breast cancer. This is the future of what cancer treatment is going to be.
Mm. Yeah, somebody I'm very close to had breast cancer, a pretty aggressive form of it.
And
you mentioned breast cancer. She's in remission, but there's a good chance it'll come back.
Yeah,
so I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
There's some research that's being done to work on that, and hopefully other forms of cancer too.
Right. We have somebody on our board is battling breast cancer, and she is now on a clinical trial for immunotherapy. And it's funny, as we were riding up in the elevator here, we met a gentleman who is battling pancreatic cancer, and he, without even being prompted, he said, "I'm on immunotherapy and feeling much better." And so that's going to be the future. Yeah. And it's so promising to see how easy it is for the body to actually fight the cancer cells.
And you just have to give it some type of a key to unlock that?
So I'm not a scientist, so I can't speak directly to it. But what we do is it's almost like you're taking the brakes off the immune system so that it, and helping it to identify the cancer cells. And how it started is fascinating. Dr. June, who is a researcher out of Pennsylvania, had this idea in the 1990s. He felt like he could use the HIV virus to reprogram it to fight cancer. And that is, LLS started funding him in the 1990s. And if you think about what HIV, like how heavy that was in the 90s, it was really risky. And it took us 20 years. We invested over $40 million. And that was the first FDA-approved treatment. And it was approved for pediatric ALL patients that didn't have any other options. And that's kind of where it started. And now, I mean, that's all we hear about is immunotherapy and how it's going to be the future.
Mm-hmm. How does it make you feel to be involved in this type of, you know, seeing these results and this research and seeing people have hope?
Oh, my gosh. It just... It brings so much meaning to my day. And personally, my husband's a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor. And he was diagnosed 7 years ago. And when we had his five-year, you're free, you're no longer going to have cancer meeting, I asked his oncologist, you know, what happens if he relapses? And his oncologist said, well, there's this new immunotherapy for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients. I keep going back to that. That was 2 years ago that happened. I keep going back to that. And I know how I felt personally when a loved one, you know, when in just 6 years, the treatment has come so far. And it just, it makes it easier for me to meet newly diagnosed patients because I have so much hope in their treatment. And I have so much hope for them. And you can see it in them, too.
So it is very gratifying.
Yeah.
It's a great time to be involved in this after waiting 40 years for new drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Our doctor, Dr. Liu, our CEO, he is famous for saying, it's never a good time to have cancer, but it's a phenomenal time to be fighting it. And he also will talk about curing cancer as a marathon. But lately in the last year, he's been finishing that thought by saying, we're sprinting to the finish line. And just some proof of that is in the last 2 years, since 2017, there have been 39 new FDA-approved treatments for blood cancers. LLS has funded 34 of those. And just to put that into perspective, prior to 2017, if we had two or three new FDA approvals in a year, we'd be so proud. We'd be like, yes, we're amazing. And now to see 39, and there's more. It seems like monthly all of a sudden we have new options and stuff. So I'm so hopeful.
So all that investment of time and research and enormous amounts of money is finally starting to pay off.
Yes, it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of investment, and it's risky. I think the statistic is only one out of every 10 clinical trials are actually going to be successful, meaning that the drug will work. But at the same time, knowing that those other 9 clinical trials didn't work is still a success, because that's one step closer to understanding how we treat our patients. But it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money and a lot of focus. And we're also learning just through the BDA AML trial. It takes a lot of collaboration, and the healthcare industry is seeing that, and we're seeing how important it is for all of us to work together so that we can get to the cures faster.
Is it tricky to get big companies to invest in something that, you know, like you said, is an orphan disease that doesn't have a lot of patients?
Yes. Yep, it is tricky. Because money talks, and so if it's not a huge patient population that this drug may actually support, then that may not be as important to some companies. That's where we step in. We have a program, we call it TAP, the Therapy Acceleration Program. And what we do is if we see a drug that a biomedical company is actually showing some positive results for, LLS will invest in that drug, and we almost set up, for lack of a better term, a bridge loan, where we will help the biomedical company study the drug, see if it works, and we'll get it to clinical trial, and we will invest in it, and then we will be the ones to kind of help bring it to the pharmaceutical companies. And that was a program that we started over 10 years ago, and now we're starting to see some of the drugs that we've helped are actually coming to market and being approved by the FDA.
And again, that was Stephanie Carlson with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society talking with me about her group's contributions to the new drugs that are now saving people's lives from cancer. There is currently a trial underway headquartered at Oregon Health Science University investigating the effects of the 8 newly approved drugs this year for acute myeloid leukemia.
My People's Market is a special project of Prosper Portland and Travel Portland. The idea is to bring more communities to the table for city-funded cultural events with food and music and a whole lot more. Here to talk about it with us tonight is Amanda Park from Prosper Portland and Michelle Comer from Travel Portland. We so appreciate you guys being in here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the first question I want to ask is I want to clarify a little bit because I was sort of confused. What is My People's Market? Is it a permanent place where people can come and set up with the local artisans, or is it an event? Explain exactly what it is.
So My People's Market is an event that happens twice a year. It's usually around June, and then the second one is in the fall in November, first or second weekend. It is an amazing collective of people that come together that it pops up all over the city. We try to pop up whenever there's a large space. It's anywhere from 25,000 square feet to 60,000 square feet of space of things going on with community connections. We have music, we have food, we have vendors. It's just a great time for communities of color to come together and celebrate.
Can you tell us why you started My People's Market? Why was there a need for it here?
Right. So I work for Travel Portland, and so we are often compared to other cities along the West Coast. In 2016, the article came out in the Atlantic about Portland being the whitest city in the United States, which, yes, we are. But when you say that, you just talk about the 70% of people that live here, and you don't talk about the other 25 to 30% people of color that are here, you're just erasing an entire group of people. So we really wanted to show that, oh, yeah, there are a lot of white people here in Portland, but guess what? There's also an amazing group of people of color here that are doing things that are unique and outside the box, or people will be really surprised to hear about them and meet them and hear their stories.
So this year, where is My People's Marketplace going to be? You said there was two events a year, is mm-hmm. that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so our next event coming up on June 1st is going to be at the post office on the corner of 9th and Lovejoy. We're actually sort of behind the post office in a huge parking lot. It's part of a development project called the Broadway Corridor, and we're really excited to bring this event into a space that the city is investing in developing and helping bring communities of color to envision what the future of the space might look like.
And you're billing this as the marketplace of the future.
Yeah.
Does that entail, are you really referring to how Portland's demographics are changing?
Yes, and I think we're also talking about what the future of Portland can look like as a more inclusive space that's inviting communities of color to the table to affect what the future looks like.
So there's a youth marketplace, there's also a museum walk, there's a lot of things involved in this, not just the marketplace with booths and music and food. Explain some of the other events that are happening.
Right, so we have what we're calling a place to connect, and that is a space where there's also going to be the Broadway Corridor design is going to be there so people can see that. But then also we're going to have different cultural museum pop-ups there, and that's Oregon Black Pioneers, Nikkei Center, Old Town, Chinatown Museum. One more. Who's the other one?
Albina.
Oh, yeah, Albina Queens. But Albina Queens is also talking about the current state, too, and showing pictures.
So there's going to be museums actually on site.
Just little pop-up banners.
Little pop-up museums. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's way cool.
Yeah, and we're doing other things like a place to heal, where we're going to have this amazing little bike tent set up there, and they'll be offering tea and also massages there. A place to play where we have a big giant breakdancing floor in the center, so hopefully you can learn some new moves.
Oh. Yes, sign
and play
me up
some
for
games.
That.
Yeah, bring your comfy shoes. Yeah, it's really important to us to have a lot of connection points for community.
Cool. Well, part of the marketplace is also about educating people on the city's plans to develop the downtown post office site on Broadway. Can you fill us in on those plans a bit?
Yeah, so the Broadway Corridor development project has been going on for a long time. They've been going through a community engagement process to sort of develop what the next concept, what the concept might be for that site. They actually have a meeting coming up June 4th. Mm-hmm. You can go to BroadwayCorridorPDX.com to learn more about that meeting. And that's where they are kind of exploring what the next steps might be.
For their development projects.
Yeah.
14 acres, so it's going to be really exciting to see what happens.
Really cool.
So the marketplace itself is on June 1st, but there's another event happening the day before, May 31st, that is going to be this trade show with POC-owned businesses and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So it's definitely a citywide initiative. I don't know if you've heard about Portland Means Progress, but they're challenging a lot of organizations to go and expand their procurement options and their vendors and build wealth within communities of color through opening up their contracting and buying options. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is making it as easy as possible. We have 100 or so businesses owned by people of color. I'm inviting all of the organizations in to come and meet new contractors and vendoring opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea if you want to go shopping, or even better, if you want to have something very tasty to eat? Can you name some of the businesses that are involved?
Yes, talk about that.
So I should say we have 130 plus businesses signed up to participate in the market. This is a huge market, 60,000 square feet, with almost more than maybe 30 different food vendors. You can go to mypeoplesmarket.com to see the full list of the vendors that have signed up, but you can get some really amazing things. Parker Simone Designs makes these beautiful Portland wraps. We have
Black Star Grill,
Spice of Africa, Mexican making their famous piña coladas. Chauncey King from Royalty Spirits is running all the bars at the market. That's right, we have bars.
you had me at piña coladas.
Yeah, that, it really, like, you'll come and maybe think you're going to be there for a half hour, an hour, and you'll end up staying the whole day. There's so much going on. With two stages, more than probably 20 different acts curated by our friends and partners at YGB. Shout out YGB. it's a great event, and there's just things going on all day. So, and something for everybody. I mean, we've really been intentional in setting up the event so that folks of all ages can come and find something for them.
Well, one of the goals of this project is to make Portland a more welcoming city for people in communities of color. How do you think that this event is going to do that?
So this event's completely different than others. It's been very interesting and a fun journey to work with Prosper Portland and the city funded, because we both have the same goal in mind. And what the nice thing is, it's managers doing it. Everyone that started this and created it and has been managing it, we're all people of color. And so, Amanda, how do you like to say it? We what?
Oh, we do it with our community, not for our community. And I think, you know, from the very beginning of this project and other projects that we do alongside My People's Market, like, that's been critical in making sure that folks of color are always at the table when we're talking about what might be possible.
Okay, let's go through the when and where one more time so
yeah,
people can make sure they
definitely
know where to go. Okay, we're talking about My People's Market, and it's going to tell us about when and where it's going to be.
June 1st. From 12 to 7 p.m., the corner of 9th and Lovejoy. You can go to mypeoplesmarket.com to find more about who's going to be performing, what businesses are going to be there. And, you know, we're always looking for support. So if you are interested in sponsoring or supporting the market, you can go to mypeoplesmarket.com and do that there as well.
Is it free admission to get in? Or
it
is
sure
there?
Is.
Oh,
yes.
That's the best part. We want you to spend your money with the people who
that's right. Spend all your money with the businesses. They've got amazing things for you.
And we want you to bring your entire family.
Yeah.
Everyone. Yeah.
So it is lots of kid-friendly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that you actually do a couple times a year now.
Yeah, twice a year. So like Michelle had mentioned, we do one in the spring, summer, so June. And then our next one will be in November. You can save the date if you want, but it might move. We're looking at November 8th. It's a great event, though, so you probably do want to mark your calendar now.
Get that holiday shopping
that's
done
right.
early.
Yes. Yes.
With
that's
all
right.
kinds of unique gifts,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
The most unique gifts in the world you will find at a place like this, right?
Yes. Oh, and we're crazy active on Instagram, so if you want to follow us, it's at My People's Market. Great pictures, and you'll see all sorts of things that the vendors, the businesses and the vendors that will be there and the different products.
What kinds of, like, really unique things will you find at My People's Market that you wouldn't see anywhere else?
Okay, so we have, we have our aroma rocks. She has this salt rock that you put in your shower. So you take the container, you shake it really good, and it smells amazing. Then, sorry if I messed this up, but you put it on the floor of the shower and you turn your shower on, and it just like steams your shower in beautiful scents. It's amazing.
Wow. Again, I'm still thinking about the piña colada.
I know.
That'll be good, too. Okay.
But, yeah, there's so much.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. I understand we're running out of time, but one more time, if people want to go to My People's Market, it's coming up on June 1st, and you can go online. There is a website to check out. There's 130 vendors. So thank you, ladies, for coming in and talking
to
us.
Thank you.
News in depth.
MyPeople'sMarket.com. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Saturday, May 18th, 2019, KBOO is co-sponsoring Palestinian Cultural Night, featuring Palestinian music, a dabka dancing workshop, and an iftar meal of traditional Palestinian food. The event will be from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Native American Student and Cultural Center at Portland State University, located at 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. That's this Saturday, May 18th, from 7 to 10 p.m., Palestinian Cultural Night.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell us an Indian first then?
Hello, Portland. You're listening to Rose City Native Radio. I'm your host, Jack Malmstrom. Joining me in the studio is Nick Yellowhorse. He'll be on in just a bit. We have a special guest coming up, so stay tuned. We're going to start off the show with Mob Bounce, Oral Tradition, here on Rose City Native Radio, KBOO Portland.
Tree of life.